So I want to dedicate the class today for Refuah Shleima for two people. Number one, for Yehudis Esther Bassara Miriam, that's Joe's wife, Julie, she should have Refuah Shleima. And also for the Refuah Shleima of Gidon Ben Rochel, the father of Jamie Howard, who is a Torah Anytime watcher or listener of this class. So he shall have a Refuah Shleima, Gidon Ben Rochel. Okay, so Parsha this week is Parsha's Vayishlach. And again, one of the jam-packed, very, very important Parshias of revealing to us so many fundamental ideas about the relationship of the Jewish people to the forces of evil, to Esav, and the lessons for all future generations about how to deal with the forces of negativity, the forces of evil, because this is the parasha of the encounter, of the meeting between Yaakov and Esav. As we know, Yaakov has already spent 20 years in Haran, where he got married and the Shvatim had been born already, but he was there originally because he'd fled from Esav, because Esav wanted to kill him, because he'd quote-unquote stolen the brachas from him. It was given to him legitimately. He had the right to them, but at least from the perspective of Esav, he thought they were stolen. He thought he'd stolen them from him. And he was resolute and determined to take the life of Yaakov, and therefore Yaakov fled to Haran, where he spent the 20 years, actually 14 years on the way to before he got to Haran, 14 years in Yeshiva Shem Neva, where he prepared himself. We discussed that last week or the week before, where he prepared himself for the dark night of Golus, the dark night of being in exile. And then he goes to Haran, where he spends 20 years working for Lavan, getting married, birth of the Shvatim, and now he comes back. And this parasha is his journey back to Eretz Yisrael, where he knows he's going to have to encounter Esav. And he prepares for that encounter. He sends messengers. Actually, Rashi says, Malachim Mamish, real angels he sent ahead of him to speak to Esav, to tell him that we're coming. And he had gifts to give. He had all these different ways to prepare himself. And they meet. But before they meet, before they actually have that physical encounter, that physical meeting with each other, we know he also had this very famous and very seminal experience of the struggle with the spiritual manifestation of Esav. The truth is, perhaps you could say it the other way around, the real essence of the person is the spiritual dimension of the person. The physical part of ourselves is the embodiment of the spiritual nature of who we are. We tend to look at it the other way around. We think that we are a physical being with a spiritual part. Really, truth be told, it's the other way around. We're really spiritual entities. We have the neshama, the spiritual part of us is the real part of ourselves, and then the physical embodiment of that is the external part of ourselves. So he first has this encounter, this experience of a struggle, an actual fight with the Sarshal Esav, with the angel of Esav, the ministering angel of Esav. And he has the struggle, he has the fight through the night, and then Yaakov defeats him. He's able to defeat the angel, and then the angel requests, he wants to go back up to the heavens and to be released, and he says, only if you give me a bracha first. And that's where the Sarshal Esav acquiesces, the angel of Esav acquiesces and agrees with the bracha that Yaakov received, and he acknowledged it, and that's that. And then the next part of the parasha then goes into the actual physical encounter, the actual physical meeting of Yaakov and Esav. That's chapter 33. So the pasuk says, Yaakov raised his eyes. He lifted his eyes and he saw, this is as he's approaching Esav, and behold, Esav was coming towards him with 400 men. And then he divided his family, divided the whole family with the Shvatim, the tribes, divided them into four groups. First of all, Zilpah and her children, and then Bilhah with her children, and Leah with her children, and then Rachel at the very back. And there's a discussion about that. If we have time, we'll need to talk about that later on. But then verse 3 says, then he himself went on ahead of them. Yaakov himself went ahead of all of his wives and children to make sure he's the front person, not putting his children and his wives in any kind of danger. So he goes ahead of that. And he comes towards Esav, and he bows earthward seven times until he reaches his brother. He bows before him, prostrates himself, and then Esav runs towards him, embraces him, falls upon his neck, and kisses him. Then they weep. He raises his eyes, and the parsha goes on. The story goes on. So I want to zoom in on that encounter, that particular meeting over here, where Yaakov is bowing down to him. He's prostrating himself towards him. And then Esav runs towards him, embraces him, and he kisses him. So this is a little bit of a window, as we'll see. It's a window into, again, this phenomena of the meeting of good and evil, of good and evil. When I say good and evil, it can happen on a micro level, it can happen on a micro level. Good and evil can be on a micro, on a macro level, is the forces of good and evil which encounter each other in the world at large. But the micro level, the forces of good and evil meeting each other is within ourselves, is the Yetzer Hara, because Esav is representative and symbolic of the force of evil. He is the force of evil. He is the nemesis, the antithesis of Yaakov. Yaakov is the Bechir Sheba Avos, is the third of the patriarchs. He is the completion of the foundation of the Jewish people. He is representative. He is, embodies the Midah of Emes, of truth, Torah. So he is the completion. It's called the Bechir Sheba Avos, the choicest of the patriarchs. He's the completion of that foundation of the Jewish people. That's Yaakov on the one hand. But his twin brother is the antithesis of that, is the nemesis of good. And he is the embodiment of Ra, of evil. So this is the reality. This is the reality that we are always in. Always from the beginning till the end of time, we are in this reality of a conflict and a struggle between good and evil. Again, on a macro level, certainly we see it in the world on a macro level, but also on a micro level as well. We see that and experience it all the time. So Esav and Yaakov are symbolic of this tension between good and evil. What does Yaakov do? He bows down to him. He prostrates himself seven times. And then Esav runs towards him. And he embraces him. And he kisses him. And the pasuk, if you look at the pasuk in the Hebrew, this is one of these unusual things with the text, with the Hebrew text. It says in the Hebrew, it says, Vayishokehu, that Esav kissed him. Yishokehu. So again, there are no vowels in the Sefer Torah, but once in a while you'll see unusual things in the text of the Torah scroll. You'll see dots, you'll see like small letters, large letters. This is an example. If you have the Hebrew Chumash, you'll see above the word Vayishokehu, there are a bunch of dots on the top of that word. Vayishokehu, there are dots, and those dots appear in the Torah scroll as well. So what does that mean? He kissed him with the dots on top of them. So Rashi says, Nokot Olav, there's dots above this word, Vayishokeyo. Yesh Cholkin Bedavot Hazad, there's a machlokus in the Medrash. There are some who darshan to expound these dots to say, Shel Noshku Bekol Diba, that there was a compromise in the level of his desire to want to embrace Yaakov. So he didn't kiss him with his full heart. That's one opinion. We're not going to deal with that one. We're going to deal with the second opinion. Amar Reb Shimon ben Yochai, he said, Halachehi, b'yadua she'esa sonei le'Yaakov. It's a fact, it's a well-known fact that Esav hates Yaakov. And this you probably heard of before. It's a very famous line. Halacha b'yadua, it's a well-known principle. Halacha, it's a principle. But yadua she'esav sonei le'Yaakov. It's well-known and it's a principle that Esav hates Yaakov. This is a reality that you can't escape it. Esav has an enmity towards Yaakov. The enemies of the Jewish people have a hatred towards the Jewish people. This is a fact. However, here though, Sheninkaru Rachmov, Esav's mercy was aroused. He had mercy, but also shot this moment. V'noshko b'kol libo, and he kissed him with his entire heart. And his mercy was aroused, his compassion was aroused. And in this instance over here, Esav actually kissed Yaakov with his full heart. There was no compromise. There was no hatred. In this moment, there was no hatred. So even though, halacha b'yadua, she'esav son of Yaakov, that Esav hates Yaakov, there is a point over here in this parasha, in this pasuk over here, that Esav does not hate Yaakov, that Esav loves Yaakov. That Esav loves Yaakov and he kisses him with his full heart. Why is that? What happened? because he bowed down to him, because he gave him honor, because he bowed down and gave him homage and honor by bowing down to him. Is that all it is? You know, it sounds strange that because he gets all this honor, now he loves him with his full heart. I mean, if Esav is the embodiment of this antithesis to the good of Yaakov, then is that all it takes just for him to bow down to him, to stroke him on his back and stroke his ego, make him feel good, that he gets all this honor, he gets the presence as well, he was given gifts as well. Is that all it takes for him to now love? I mean, when we say that Esav hates Yaakov, we're not talking superficially, we're talking about on a very, very deep level, that Esav hates Yaakov. So it seems strange that he should suddenly switch and become a lover of Yaakov because he receives all this honor. So it needs explanation. So that's the question on the table. So I saw I have a sefer over here. It's got this a number of years ago. And he, this is a course sefer called Meir Derech. Very, very, you know, inspiring. So he tells us, he discusses another episode, fast forward in Jewish history to another episode when there's a similar type of episode, similar type of encounter between not Yaakov and Esav, but Rav Acha bar Yaakov and some type of symbol of Esav. Rav Acha bar Yaakov. So Rav Acha bar Yaakov was one of the sages of the Gemara. And this story for our Monday morning Gemara class, Gemara Sleuth Society on Monday mornings, right? We learn Kedusha on Monday mornings. So on 29B, there's a story over there about Rav Acha bar Yaakov. And we learned this a few weeks ago in one of the classes. Rav Acha bar Yaakov is one of the sages of the Gemara. And the Gemara is discussing the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, of learning Torah and teaching Torah to a child. So the Gemara says the Rav Acha bar Yaakov had a son Yaakov that he first sent him to yeshiva to learn, to the yeshiva of Abaye, the academy of Abaye. And when his son wasn't doing as well as he thought he could do, he came home, and then Rav Acha bar Yaakov himself decided to go to the yeshiva himself. And the Gemara relates how Rav Acha bar Yaakov goes to the yeshiva of Abaye, famous sage Abaye, and he goes there, and he's on his way, and Abaye got wind of the fact that he's coming. The Rav Acha bar Yaakov came. Now, Rav Acha bar Yaakov, even though he was deciding to go himself, he was also a very, very prominent sage. But obviously, the academy, the yeshiva of Abaye, was such a spectacular place. The Rav Acha bar Yaakov wanted to learn there as well. But Abaye, the Rosh Yeshiva, heard that Rav Acha bar Yaakov was coming. And he said, and he told the Talmidim in the yeshiva, he said, listen, you know, I want you to do the following. Make sure not to give Rav Acha bar Yaakov any place to sleep. He's going to be coming to the yeshiva. Make sure he's not given any lodging and any place to sleep in the community, in the town. Because this way, he'll be forced to sleep in the Beis Medrash. And if he's forced to sleep in the Beis Medrash, then hopefully Rav Acha bar Yaakov's merit will succeed in being able to extinguish the terrible mazik, the terrible demon, which resides in this Beis Medrash. In the Beis Medrash of Abaye, there was the Gemara describes, like a serpent with seven heads. It was a demon, it was a spiritual force of whatever it was, a demon, a mazik, as we call it. But it was a serpent of seven heads, a very, very spiritually dangerous entity. And Abaye said to his Talmidim, you know, this way, if we don't give him a place to sleep, he'll sleep at the Beis Medrash, and his merit will be able to be so strong, he'll be able to knock out this mazik, this demon inside the Beis Medrash. Now, it's a question, why would he put him into danger this way? We'll discuss that later on. But this is what happened. So Rav Acha bar Yaakov came to the yeshiva, and he came there, and no one offered him a place to sleep, and he was compelled to sleep at the Beis Medrash. And lo and behold, this mazik, this serpent with seven heads, appears before him. And then the Gemara says that when he appeared before Idmile Katanina, the Shiva Reshvase, is a serpent with seven heads, and then Kalkriya Dekora, every bow and every prostration the Rav Acha bar Yaakov did, Nosa Chad Reshe, one head was severed off, one head disappeared. Seven times, he prostrates himself seven times, and each time one of the heads of the serpents goes away, And eventually all the heads disappeared. So all perhaps was left was just the body of the serpent, but it no longer posed any danger anymore. And it was over. So the serpent, the danger of the serpent was over. So what does that sound like? It sounds a little bit of similar to this, not Yaakov Avinu, but this is Rav Acha Bar Yaakov, Rav Acha, the son of Yaakov, that he also had this encounter. Now, when we talk about the serpent, when you talk about the forces of evil, it's brought down that with the Nachash, with the primordial snake, this primordial serpent which came into the world, seven forces, the Marsha says this on this Gemara, seven forces of evil came into the world with the emergence of when the Nachash HaKadmoni came into the world, seven forces of evil. So it makes sense that you've got this serpent over here with seven heads, representative of the seven forces of evil. If Esav is the embodiment of Ra, then it makes sense also that there should be some kind of procedure, some kind of ceremony, some type of force of bowing down, prostrating yourself seven times to get rid of the force of evil. And that's what Rav Acha Bar Yaakov is doing over here. He's prostrating himself seven times to knock off and to eliminate the seven heads of the serpent, and he succeeds. And this is reminiscent of Yaakov Avinu, bowing down and getting rid of, subduing whatever, however he's doing it, subduing the force of Esav. Now, Rav Acha Bar Yaakov is doing this. The question is what exactly is his kavana? What is the intention? What is he thinking about when he's bowing down? So, quotes over here, the Makna is one of the commentaries on the Gemara, famous commentary on the Gemara, and the Makna, Sefer Makna says that when you're encountering evil, when you're fighting evil, there are two ways to fight evil. One way to fight evil is by combative destruction, by just destroying the evil, by combating it and destroying it. That's one way. The other way to fight evil is by transforming the evil into good. Now, this is a much longer, much more deeper approach to combating evil, but it's the method of controlling and having dominion over the forces of evil in a non-violent fashion. Sometimes it's not a prescription. Obviously, there are times when you have to use violence, no question, or physical destruction, no question about it. But another way to destroy evil is by using a more of a transformative technique, a strategy of transforming the evil into good. Now, ideally, that is the goal. That is the desire, ultimately, because we should see all evil and all of the mongers of evil turn around to do teshuvah, to do good. That's our wish, that's our hope, and that's our dream for society, that all of the evil mongers of society should do teshuvah and do good. So really, our design even says, Pasuk says, that Hashem does not desire the death of Rishayim. He desires the teshuvah of Rishayim, wants the Rishayim to do teshuvah. So if our approach and our methodology is violent, combative destruction, it's not the ideal. The ideal way is to turn evil into good, to turn it all around, to make a mahapecha of evil to good. And this, he says, is what Rav Acha Bar Yaakov is doing. And this is also what Yaakov Avinu is doing as well. Because the bowing down, the prostration, before Esav, and the prostration that Rav Acha Bar Yaakov is doing before this seven-headed snake is really a symbolic of a, not of a powerful, overpowering, and a controlling, or a destroying type of movement, but it's more of an expression of dominion. I have power over you. Now, even though I was thinking, like, when you're bowing down, it looks like you're giving in. But it's not really giving in to submission and then allowing the force of evil to have control over you. But it's really more of an act of bowing down that I have dominion, I have control, I have mastery over you. I have mastery over you, and I'm not approaching you with this combative, negative force of destruction, but I'm control. I have mastery over you, and I'm bowing down and prostrating myself in this act of dominion and power over you. And that's the better approach. Now, that's the goal. The goal is to turn and to control, have dominion over the Ra, over the evil, to then turn it around. When you are bowing down, though, there is a feeling then from the side of Ra, from the side of evil, that there's a certain kind of honor which is being given. And it's a consolement to the force of evil. But really the mindset of the person bowing down is, I'm controlling you, I have dominion over you. Rav Acha bar Yaakov, same Rav Acha bar Yaakov, it says in Bava Basra, in different Gemara, it says that he was the one who said, he made a statement, he says, the Satan has kavana l'shem shemayim. What does that mean? The Satan does what it does for the sake of heaven. The Satan acts for the sake of heaven. The Satan behaves, the Satan traps us, the Satan distracts us, the Satan seduces us for the sake of heaven, l'shem shemayim. What does that mean? The answer is because there is no ultimate force of evil in the world. Everything in the world is created by God. Even the Satan, we've learned this before, right? The Satan is created for the sake of bringing to us challenges and the opportunity to choose in order to create our own spirituality and to grow closer to Hashem. That's the purpose of the Satan. So it's understandable that really intrinsic in the energy and the psychology, so to speak, of the Satan is its own desire to be subdued, because it doesn't want man to be controlled by it. It wants man to control it, to have dominion over it, to destroy it and to kill it, to be combative and to kill it. You know, that's a different approach. That's not what we're discussing. Right now, we're talking about the approach of having power over it and having self-control over the forces of evil in our life and in the world, because the Satan itself wants that. The Satan itself desires that. The force of evil wants to be subdued for the sake of us. So he says, the Gemara, he says, Satan, and actually the Gemara speaks about Penina in the story of beginning of Shmuel Aleph, story of Penina and Chana, where Penina tormented Chana. He says, Satan upenina l'shem shemayim niskavno. They do what they do. They practice their skill l'shem shemayim, for the sake of heaven. The Satan does it for the sake of heaven because it wants us to subdue it. So the act of prostrating and the act of bowing down is an act of controlling it. It's a symbolic act of showing control and dominion over the force of evil, so that now the Esav should now turn around and be happy. Happy sounds strange, but it sounds to be happy with the fact that Esav has been subdued. Esav, Satan, wants to be controlled, wants us to have dominion over it. And therefore, that's why the Medrash says that he kissed him in that moment, because he felt, because Esav understood that Yaakov had control and dominion over the force of evil and has control over him. And Esav wants that in his heart of heart of hearts. He really wants to be controlled by Yaakov. And this also explains why in the previous episode, when there was the battle with the Sashal Esav, the angel of Esav, so he's struggling with him. There it's more of a physical struggle, but it's not Yaakov who begins it. It's the Sashal Esav who begins that struggle. So he's having more of a physical struggle. And then in the middle, towards the end of the night, when they're struggling and they're fighting, all of a sudden the angel says to Esav, "Let me go." Right, the pasuk says, "Let me go," because the morning has arrived. And the Medrash says, "Let me go because I want to go upstairs to sing Shira to Hashem. I want to sing song to Hashem. I want to daven to Hashem. I want to sing song to Hashem in the heavens." Why now? Like why bedafka now? Why specifically at this point now in this juncture? So the Rechaim Briska says the reason is because once the Sashal Esav, the angel of Esav, saw that Yaakov had power over it, then now it's a time to say Shira to Hashem. Because a malach, an angel, for all of us really, shouldn't sing any kind of songs to Hashem except in appreciation, in gratitude for what Hashem has given to us. And even angels as well. Angels sing Shira to Hashem for gratitude. So what is the gratitude that this Sashal Esav, the angel of Esav, is singing to Hashem? The song he's singing is a song of gratitude. You vanquished me. You have overcome me. You've had control over me. You've shown your dominion, your power over me. I'm really happy about that. I'm only set up as a puppet. I'm only set up as a puppet to entice you and to seduce you, to get you to at least dangle the enticement in front of you, for you to go ahead to try to think that you want it and then to control it. And that control over me is my celebration. It's my celebration. And I'm going to say, Baruch Hashem, you vanquished me. And therefore the angel goes up to Shemayim and says, Baruch Hashem, sing Shira to Hashem. That's really the innate, the intrinsic desire of the Yetzer Hara, of the Satan, of the Malach HaMavi. they all play their parts. They all play their parts. They're all commissioned to do different jobs. But really, the so to speak, the inner desire of the force of evil is it wants us to be able to have control over it and to have dominion over it, because it's there for our growth. It's there for our growth. This reminds me of a pasuk in early in Bereishis, in Parshas Bereishis, after Cain killed Hevel. So the pasuk says that Pesach Chattas Rovates, right? That sin crouches at the door. Sin crouches at the door, famous pasuk. Pasuk says, Ve'ilecha Tushukoso, to you is its desire. Sin crouches, like sin, again, sin, Yetzahara, evil, crouches at the door. Eilecha Tushukoso, to you is its desire. Its desire is to you. So it sounds like, superficially, it sounds like it's trying to get you, trying to get you, trying to get you. Ve'ata Timshalbo, and you shall dominate it. So Rav Hirsch over here, I'll read it. He says, its power, sin, the appeal of the senses, its power is not to be underestimated. It has the power to master you. It definitely has the power to master you, but it remains quietly behind your door. It doesn't come into you by itself, uninvited. If it is at home with you, yes, finally to become the master of your house, you must, in the first instance, have invited it in. If the Yetzirah is inside our home, it must be we've invited it in. We set a chair for it at our table. By itself, though, left to its own devices, it remains quietly in front of your door, outside of your house. Moreover, all of its desire is that you should master it and direct it. Hashem has given sensuality an appeal, no question, to your senses, but not that it should master and direct you, but that you should master and direct it. Not that you should suppress or kill it, not to kill it, but timshol, which regulate it. The goal is to regulate, have power over it, not in a combative, destructive, violent way to destroy it, but to regulate it, rule over it, have dominion over it, direct it. That is its whole purpose and calling. By you mastering it and guiding it, it achieves its purpose. And that is why it longs to achieve it. It wants that. The Ra wants to be controlled. It's there as a puppet to entice us, for us to then control it, to then achieve our purpose and to grow and to become to actualize ourselves. For there is not a single natural tendency in man which is in itself either good or bad. And he says further, a man should be freely engaged to his sensuality so as under his guidance together with it to achieve the highest purposes of his life. So beautiful. It's so powerful and so beautiful. It just gives us the understanding of what the healthy, wise approach to the force, so to speak, of evil, of Ra in the world. Now, obviously, when Ra is unleashed, when the Yetzirah is unleashed, when it's brought into our house, it kind of does terrible things. But the actual enticement itself, the enticement of sensuality, the enticement, all of the different things in the world which entice us, on the initial level, on the true level, that enticement is in order for us to have regulation and control over it. And there are times, obviously, when we're allowed to and even obligated to engage in whatever physical things the sensuality is in the world. But the real dynamic is to have dominion over it. And that's symbolic of the bowing down. I'm in control of you. I have dominion over you. I'm in control of you. I'm not going to kill you and rip you apart and destroy you. That's what the Yetzirah wants. That's what Esav reacted to. And he kisses and embraces Yaakov. And that's what the Sarshal Esav reacted to. And as soon as it felt this mastery, this mature mastery over it, I'm going to Shemayim. I want to say thank you to Hashem for that. And that is what that's how he explains it. It's a beautiful explanation. And again, it's Rav Acha Bar Yaakov. He was Rav Acha in that story in the Gemara. He was Rav Acha, the son of Yaakov, because he had learned this lesson from Yaakov Avinu. And that's how this story goes. Now, that's just, well, the take home of that is for 2 points to just to think about. Number one is the basic idea that Ra is not intrinsically bad. Ra is here for a purpose. God created Ra as well, created the Yetzirah for our betterment. He created the Yetzirah for our betterment. That's what we've said many times before, right? Ra, if you change the vowelation of the word Ra, you have the word Rea. He's like a friend. It's a comrade, because Ra facilitates the ability for a person to choose, to be able to choose good. The Yetzirah facilitates that. But also on an internal level, a micro level, thinking about this, is how do we relate to the Ra inside of ourselves? If we feel within ourselves this kind of pull to beating ourselves up inside because of the Ra, the Yetzirah, which is inside of it, that's not healthy. That's not the ideal way to deal with the Ra inside of ourselves. It's not to beat ourselves up and to be violent, God forbid, I mean, not to be offensively violent, but, you know, so to speak, to have this combative kind of nature inside of ourselves, to combat the negativity inside of ourselves, not so effective, right? The most effective way is to try to contain it, to contain the Yetzirah, to be a mastery, to have a sense of leadership, a leadership role towards the negativity inside of ourselves. It's the neshamah inside, and that is the part of ourselves which is able to be able to have mastery, to have control over us. That's one thing. But the other thing which I want to say is this, which is related to that Gemara, which is the, how did Abaye have such a confidence to invite Rav Acha bar Yaakov to come and sleep at the Beis Medrash and have the merit to be able to knock off and destroy the serpent with seven heads? You know, back to that story, right? Even though he was successful and he had definitely had the merit, but how was Abaye so confident that he was going to be able to do that? And wasn't it wrong for him to do that? For Abaye to tell the students, you know, don't give any lodging to Rav Acha bar Yaakov and have him sleep in the Beis Medrash instead and be subject to the serpent, which is going to be a dangerous force against him. How was that? How was Abaye able to do that? So, you know, one explanation is because he had the merit. He believed he had the merit. He had the zechus. He was a very righteous man. Rav Acha bar Yaakov, he just had confidence that he was a very righteous person. He had, and he didn't feel he was putting him in any danger. So that's one explanation. The Marsha says something else, though. He says that he knew, that Abaye knew about Rav Acha bar Yaakov, that he certainly would be able to rely upon his chassidus, his piety. And he knew that through his tefillah, through his prayers, lo yeh nizok, he wouldn't be damaged. He understood that Rav Acha bar Yaakov was a very pious man, and he would pray, and he would daven, and his tefillah would certainly help him to not be injured. And here's the line over here. Because through tefillah, if a person davens, then that danger is no longer a danger. And it's not even a miracle anymore, because actually I just want to rewind, backtrack a second. The question he asks over here, how could Abaye put Rav Acha bar Yaakov into a situation when Rav Acha bar Yaakov now is going to depend upon a miracle? Because certainly getting rid of this serpent with seven heads requires some kind of miracle. So how could Abaye be so sure or put a person into a situation where they have to depend upon a miracle? You can't put yourself into a situation of danger where you have to depend upon a miracle. You're not supposed to do that. You know, you have to keep yourself safe. So how could Abaye subject Rav Acha bar Yaakov to a circumstance where Rav Acha bar Yaakov was then going to be dependent upon a miracle to be safe? And the answer is, the Marshal says, is because he knew about the piety of Rav Acha bar Yaakov and his power of tefillah, his power of prayer, and his power of prayer would be so great that if he would be answered through his prayer, it wouldn't be a miracle, because prayer, the efficacy of prayer, is it turns a miracle into teva, into nature. That is the power of prayer. He says it teaches that the power of prayer, something which would otherwise be called a miracle, al yedei tefila, through tefila, hofech leteva, it turns that into nature. Because Hashem implanted into the nature of existence, tefillah has the power to save. We tend to look at prayer as a miraculous intervention. He's saying, no, the prayer is not a miraculous intervention. Prayer is a natural intervention. It's a mechanism of intervention. And through the power of prayer, we can actually turn something which would otherwise require a miracle into nature. For example, if you go, if you take a gun and you shoot something, or you take a hammer, you break something, that's not called a miracle. You're using a natural means, a natural tool of a hammer to break it. You wouldn't call that a miracle. If you don't have a mirror, if you don't have a hammer and you want to break something, then you're going to need a miracle. But if you use tefillah, if you don't have a hammer and now you use tefillah, that's like using a hammer. Tefillah is like a natural means to destroy or to do whatever you want to try to do. It's not a miracle. Tefillah has the power to be able to change something which would otherwise be a miracle into something which would be natural by the power of prayer. It's an amazing idea. Prayer is not a miraculous intervention. Prayer is a mechanism of hishtadlus, of regular, normal, natural hishtadlus, natural effort. And it's very logical, because what is prayer? Tefillah is going to the boss, speaking to the one in charge and asking, you know, I can't do this over, I don't have a hammer over here. I don't have some tool in my hands to be able to achieve what I want to achieve. I don't have it over here. Can you do it for me? Well, you wouldn't call that a miracle. Is that a miracle? No. You're going to the person who's able to do it. You're going to the one who's able to do it. So please, Hashem, could you do that for me? And he goes ahead and does it. Is that called a miracle now? Not a miracle. It's natural. It's a natural intervention. That's the koach of tefillah. That's why Abaye did not look at him putting Rav Acha bar Yaakov into this base medrash to depend upon a miracle. It's a miracle because he knew how powerful his prayer was. That was the koach of his tefillah. Now, does this work for everyone? Obviously, it doesn't work for everyone. A person has to really be tuned in and understand the power of prayer. You have to really be attuned. You have to be connected. We have to raise our connection to our Kodesh Baruch Hu to really feel and understand his closeness and his presence in our lives, to then utilize this mechanism of talking to him. Please, Hashem, can you do this for me? That's the power. That is the potential power of prayer. Not all the time can we do it, and it's very hard to do it, but sometimes we can do it. And there are times when people do it, and people do tap into the power of prayer in a way which is just unbelievable, and it's able to bring about quote-unquote miracles, where it's not really a miracle, it's just a natural response of Hashem making the teva, the nature, work for that person.